This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamotu, MPR. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.mpr.nz/donate.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future.
Today I have with me
Richard Milden.
And I'm Stuart Burks.
Okay, now Richard, you grew up on a farm in Kairanga.
Kairanga, yes, yeah. We did.
And that was a sheep farm.
Sheep and cattle.
Sheep and cattle.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And as a child, you would not so much work, but you would play around some of the work being done, did you?
We didn't really get a serious farm upbringing in the sense of knowing what the farm was all about. My sisters may have felt that they did, but I was not a particularly keen or interested, I would have to say, in farming as such.
Yeah, but I hear that at certain times, you would say if there was shearing going on or something.
Yes, we did. Yes, through the various special seasons, I suppose, of the year when the lambs are coming or when we're shearing. That's when I took an interest, particularly during the August holidays, school holidays. We always, and I would say always, from quite an early age, helped with the docking. And that was always good fun because there was a fire going and there was a lot of activity, and we as kids would catch the lambs, and hold them while they were docked and otherwise doctored, and their ears clipped with our mark.
All right, so they'd be out in the paddocks.
It was out in the paddocks. Yes, we used to set up hurdles to create pens and then run a roll of wire netting right out into the paddock to act as a funnel when the sheep got brought in. And So the sheep and lambs, you would steadily gather them all together, and then when you got close to the wire netting, things would go all of a rush to get them in, so none of them changed their minds about where they wanted to go.
Okay, so that was basically everyone got involved.
Everybody was involved.
The children, the adults. Did you have other workers come in to help with
this? Yes, we always had another man on the farm as well. So there was Dad, his brother, and perhaps another chap, and then us kids as we got old enough to help with it. And that was that. Docking was always something that we looked forward to, I'd have to say. It was one of those things that we really enjoyed because there was a lot of activity, there was blood, there was noise, there was... it was interesting.
Yeah, an exciting sort of thing.
Yes,
yeah.
It was.
So, so was it a long day's work doing that?
We would probably do a good day's work, yes, morning and afternoon. Mum would come down the paddock with the basket for morning and afternoon tea.
Okay, so what would you have for that?
Oh, she'd probably have scones or something like that for us. Yeah. But we'd go back to the house for lunch.
Oh, yeah, and you'd and drink? You'd...
Dad would have a cup of tea. They'd quite possibly boil a billy on the open kerosene tin fire that they had that was used for heating the docking irons. So, Dad would have a cup of tea, and we would just drink water. Probably pop down to the trough and get a bit of water out of the ballcock.
Right. Okay, and that was all tasty water?
It was lovely water, yes. Nice, yeah. Now, our artesian water actually was quite tasty, even though the wells were very shallow.
Yeah.
Our artesian water was good water.
Oh, okay. So what other aspects of a country childhood stood out for you?
I think just simply being in the wide open spaces was the great thing. And the activities, I know that I remember going down to the when they were yarding the sheep for foot rot treatment, and we had a concrete race that would be filled up with the treatment, and the sheep would be pushed through that to get them done, and we had a plunge dip as well, which was always an interesting thing to watch. Because the sheep would be herded onto the deck, the gate would be shut behind them, and then the lever would be pulled, and the deck would tilt and the sheep would slide into the plunge dip.
Oh, right, yeah.
And then the men standing round the dip would have long poles with S-shaped hooks on the end of them to put them into the crook of the neck of the sheep to push them under and give them a good soaking.
Yeah.
And then of course the gate would be opened to the steps that led out of it, and they would come up, and the dip would stream off them, off the wall, into the channel that ran along the length of the pens, and run back into the dip.
Oh, okay.
And so it was it was pretty much self-replenishing like that.
And you just watched that.
We just watched that. That was the only time when I ever got the opportunity to do that was when I was on the farm briefly after I'd left engineering for a while, and I said to my father I'd give it a go for a time until it didn't work for me. And my brother-in-law Dennis and myself put through a lot of sheep in the plunge dip, and it was the hardest work I think I've ever had to do, because every animal had to be wrestled onto the deck, because they knew what was coming. And we found out how hard the job actually was. They didn't run freely onto the tilting deck at all.
Oh yeah, yeah, okay.
And so how
many sheep did you have it whole day to do all this?
Or? Well, on the farm we normally ran a couple of thousand sheep. I think they would get. It would take a couple of days or more to get through the whole lot.
Yeah.
And then, of course, while the dip was full, neighbours would occasionally bring their sheep over as well to take advantage of it. One neighbour in particular, I won't give his name, but he was a little bit down the road from us. He would bring his sheep over and then suddenly find a reason that he had to go back home again and leave my dad and his brother and the man on the farm to do the job.
Okay.
My father always found it difficult to say no to anybody.
So, and what about then things like hunting and shooting?
Well, there were always guns on the farm. My father and his brother went duck shooting when we were kids, and of course duck shooting was great because then we went down to what was we called the big house, which was where my grandparents lived, and the ducks would be plucked and they would be cooked and we would have them for dinner, and it was always a competition amongst us kids to see who could get the most pellets on our plate from the shotgun.
Surprisingly,
there were very few pellets found in the meat, but so hunting and shooting was something that always happened in the early days. But after about 1954-55, duck shooting went by the wayside, because I think it was such a job to get the lagoon filled with water, because they had to turn a tap on down on the swamp farm in order to...
Okay, the lagoon, that's...
We had a depression on our swamp farm at Lockwood, and there was a depression on the
farm. So there was the main farm that you lived on and another...
At Kairanga, and a few miles down the road at Lockwood, there was another farm.
Okay.
The home farm was 300 acres, the bottom farm was 200 acres.
Mm-hmm.
It had its own two-stand wool shed, but mostly the sheep were brought up home to shear them at home. But on the Lockwood farm, there was a small depression and the artesian water that ran there, Dad would turn the tap on a month or two before duck shooting, and the lagoon would fill up, and then he would go down with his brother and shoot.
Uh-huh.
I never shot on that water because I was only very, very young then.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I didn't go duck shooting until I was well into a working age, well into it.
Yeah. Would that be normal then, that a farmer would actually make their own sort of
Some farms had permanent lagoons.
Yeah. Okay.
And they would invite people from miles around to come and shoot over their lagoon.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big thing to be invited to to a shoot.
Yeah.
Pakloski's had a big lagoon round on their place at Rangiotu that was a popular one. A lot of shooting was just done along the rivers too, on the Orua River and the Manawatu River.
Okay. So were there lots of ducks?
Yes, as many ducks as you see today.
So you'd expect if they went sort of duck shooting on your farm, they come back with what, 5 ducks, 20 ducks?
In our time, I don't think Dad would ever shoot more than he thought we could eat. They didn't go for more than really necessary. But there is a photograph in the photograph album of the of the Buick car, photographed sometime before the war, and the ducks cover one side of the car.
Okay, yeah.
They're laid out all along the side of the car and on the bonnet and on the mudguards.
So you preserve them or...?
No.
They would be given away.
In those days they would have been given away.
Yeah, okay. And what about you? For you, did you do much shooting of any kind?
Well, shooting was something that I was really keen to get involved with. I thought one Christmas or one birthday that I was in for a rifle, because I got a little package that was wrapped in brown paper that looked like it was a rifle. I would have been, I would think, about 7 or 8 when it was given to me. And when I unwrapped it, I was very disappointed. It was a handsaw.
Uh-huh.
So, but I had to wait a few more years. And then eventually an air rifle was brought out. I'd known of it before. Dad's brother kept it in his workshop. And then this air rifle was brought out for me to have a few shots with. And then I was given free run with it at about 10 or 11.
So how did you learn to shoot? Were you taught or you just self-taught?
No, I was just told, don't ever point that gun at anybody. Okay. Yeah. Don't carry it loaded inside. And then the gun was mine to do with what I liked.
Did you set up a target to shoot at, or you shot at animals?
Targets were mostly live targets. Birds, blackbirds and sparrows. I was told not to shoot starlings because they were good for the farm. Thrushes were too pretty a bird to shoot. Blackbirds ate the fruit in the orchard.
Okay. Yeah.
And sparrows were a nuisance, so
I
could shoot them if I could hit them.
Yeah. Rabbits? Were there rabbits, right?
I didn't shoot a rabbit with the air rifle until I was about 12. I think the rabbit got more of a surprise than I did, because I was down at the big house once again, walking along the big line of macrocarpa trees that were there. And I just went past a big log, and there was a rabbit looking at me, and I was looking at the rabbit, and the air rifle had a pellet up the spout, and I shot it, and got my photograph taken as well.
Yeah, okay.
When I took it, I was very proud. That was my first rabbit, so...
So did you go deliberately looking for rabbits at all?
I was walking along, probably looking
for
anything.
Oh, for that time, yes.
Yeah, looking for something. But yes, later on I would deliberately... go looking for rabbits. And of course, by the time I was a few years older, I got the .22, and Dad had a single shot .22. I'd go out onto the farm specifically for shooting rabbits. When I was at high school, friends would come from town with their father's .22s, and we would shoot.
Okay, so how did you? I mean, if you're target shooting, you know if you're off and which way to go a bit further to the right or whatever.
Yeah.
Did you learn that, or it's just by practice you got the feel of where the rifle?
I just assumed that the rifle would put the pellet where I aimed it, and it did. And I'd have to say that the air rifle that I had, which was a BSA Cadet Major. I could take the eyebrows off a fly with it. It was very, very good.
Okay. Yeah. At what sort of range?
I could hit a fly probably at about 10 yards. The furthest distance I think I ever dropped a blackbird would have been 25-30 yards. More chance than anything. And I did shoot a starling once, flying into the macrocarpa trees with a single shot.
Yeah.
But I never recovered it. It knocked feathers off it anyway.
So would you find you could often just wound a bird, or normally it would...
Not too many would be. They would be pretty good, pretty clean kills. Yes, it's most disappointing when you don't get a clean hit.
So you obviously not just shooting for the bird, or normally if it hit the bird it would kill it.
It was a reasonably powerful air rifle. It wasn't a pea shooter, and it did the job quite well.
Okay. And I've also got the term here, Boy Scouts. You were in the Boy Scouts?
I was in the Boy Scouts, yes. Well, I started earlier. I started in the Cubs when I was eight. I think I went into Cubs. I was a late starter in Cubs. I could have joined earlier than that.
Yeah.
But I joined the Cubs, and then from there went into Scouts. But in the Cubs we had good leaders. Bernie Neal was one of our first leader. He actually worked on our farm on occasions as well.
Mm.
He was a local chap, an ex-serviceman. And then our next leader was Pauline Moore, who lived just around the road from us. She was to us, she was our Kayla, which was the proper name that we gave our Cub leaders.
Yeah.
And everybody liked her very much. And then eventually I got old enough, as they all did, to go into the Scouts, and most Cubs just went straight on into Scouts.
So what did you do in the Cubs?
What did we do in the Cubs?
Yeah, what activities?
We learned to tie basic knots. We were taken on camps.
Yeah.
I can remember going to Cub camps out at near Colleton, on the road between the road out to Kimbolton, or the road to Cheltenham, and the road to Colleton. There's an area there which was used quite a lot for scout camps. Other troops used them as well.
And that was all what, canvas tents and wood fires?
Canvas tents and doing our own cooking. Yes. Yep.
Yeah.
We learned basic cooking, which was one of the big things with camps. So we cooked all our own food, even though we were only youngsters. We cooked all our own food and survived.
Yeah.
Most camps were not much longer than a long weekend or something like that.
Yeah.
And I got a badge too.
Mm-hmm.
One badge. I got my collector's badge. So
all right, for collecting for collecting what?
I've forgotten. Probably for collecting stamps, I think.
Oh yeah.
Might have been and stamps and coins at that stage.
Yeah. Okay.
I didn't have much else in the way of collections then.
Yeah. And then you moved up to the Scouts.
I moved up to Scouts, and we had a leader who became extremely well known, Pat Snoxall, who was not the first leader of the Clairanga Scouts group, but he must have arrived in around about, I would think, 1958-59,
mm-hmm.
and a very popular leader and a very popular man in the district.
Because he was involved with theatre productions, wasn't he?
He was, yes, he became involved in theatrical productions, yes. He left that after Scouts. And the way he got involved in that was with the Scouts, with the Clairanga Scouts, he produced his first gang show in the Clairanga Hall.
Mm.
And then from that, in 1960, I think it was, he produced a gang show in the Opera House, which was the first of the big gang shows.
Yeah.
And the next year, 1961, he produced another one, and I was in that one.
Mm-hmm.
Had a solo turn in it as well, as a ballet dancer.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then he went on producing them after that. And because of his production skills with the gang shows, he became the producer for the local operatic society.
Mm-hmm.
And he was doing both for a while, and then eventually went entirely to theatre.
Yeah.
And I think the Scouts were handed over to another producer.
Okay, yeah.
So Pat Snoxall was a very long time person in the Clairanga district. Skipper. Skip he was, we called. That was his scout name. We called him Skip.
Yeah.
And he took us on camps every school holidays, May holidays, August holidays mostly, and Christmas holidays.
So middle of winter you went camping?
Yep.
Whereabouts? Somewhere warm or up in the hills?
No. Well, we went, I remember the furthest away we went, I think, was Whanganui. We camped down near the river. I remember we met up with the Sea Scouts there, and they rowed us across the river to the southern side of the river, and we did of exploring there, and then they rode us back again. And on the way home from the camp, I can remember we ran into a head-on. We were the first arrivals at a head-on car crash, and so we all had to whip off our scarves and get them used as bandages
for the
people that were in the cars. Oh. And we were there until an ambulance arrived. And
yeah.
So that was a little bit of first-hand experience.
So you gave them to other people to use the scarves?
I didn't do any of the first aid work at all.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So, and you did badges in the Scouts?
I got a few badges in the Scouts. I got my cyclist badge, I can remember. I didn't get many. Hmm. I'd have to look on my Scout shirt, which I've still got. I got second class and first class, and then after that I got my what was called a Scout cord, which was a green cord, tasseled cord that you wore through your left hand pocket, mm-hmm. which was slightly ahead of your first class.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't get to be a Queen Scout though. That was uh-huh. something that I wasn't ever going to get there.
Yeah. Did you stay in long though in the Scouts?
Yes, eventually from Scouts. Then there used to be Rovers after Scouts, but before I got a chance to be a Rover, they brought in what were called Venturers.
Yeah.
And Venturers, instead of wearing shorts and long socks, we wore long trousers. So we were swept up a little bit.
All right. Yeah.
And so we had long trousers and a shirt, and we still wore our Scout scarf, and a maroon beret rather than a green beret.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now that's interesting. So you all felt really good wearing long trousers. It was sort of a step up.
It was a step up, I suppose, because they considered us to be young adults, I guess. Yeah.
You see, the reason I ask, I went to school in England, and when you're in sort of sixth form in England, you'd wear long trousers. And I came here and saw the boys at school, right through school, they wore shorts. It's just interesting. They didn't feel that sixth formers at school should wear long trousers, or did the boys at school think that?
Well, at that time when I was in the Venturers, I would have been about the fourth or fifth form. I was at high school for another couple of years, and in the sixth form, with the principal that we had, we were allowed to wear long trousers.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yep.
That was the first year it was done, though.
Hmm. Yeah.
We were the first ones to wear long trousers, and so we could wear our school blazer as well. Instead of a jersey, we would wear long trousers and wore our blazer all day.
Mm. Yeah.
Looked very swank, actually.
Yeah. And did you have to wear a tie all the time?
Yes,
well?
We had a tie. Yeah. And of course, the time when we were when I was in the sixth form, trousers were beginning to narrow down, or had narrowed down from quite broad cuffs to narrow cuffs, and so I had to persuade Mum to skinny the leg of my trousers down so that they were, I think they were down to about probably 5-inch or 6-inch cuffs.
Drain pipes.
Yeah. And I used to fold my shirts and pin my shirts in at the back to tighten them up so that they fitted more snugly.
Yeah.
And my tie was eventually narrowed down to one that was not much more than 1/2 inch wide.
Yeah, and
What was the old broad school tie, which at the bottom of it would have been nearly 3 inches wide.
Yeah, and the school allowed that. That was all right. Everyone did that.
We weren't told that we couldn't do it.
Okay.
And there was some freedom with the footwear that we could wear as well.
Okay.
And I finished up wearing a pair of brown suede brothel creepers.
Okay.
Do you know what brothel creepers are? Ripple sole desert boots.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But they were called brothel creepers in those days.
Yep, sort of canvas type top
suede leather top and high boots and ripple heavy ripple sole.
Oh, heavy. Oh, so they're quite heavy boots.
Yeah. Big fat ripples on the bottom.
Okay, because I when I came here, I've been in Israel and I had some desert boots from there, and they were all really lightweight shoes, not the heavy ones. And in your time there, when you were young, obviously things have changed a lot. Now, so I was wondering, you talked a little bit about the sort of food that you had, but what sort of, growing up on the farm, did you have mainly food that you grown yourselves and kill your own stock and eat that? Or?
Well, yes, we did. We probably mainly food that we grew ourselves. Dad had a big vegetable garden, and of course there was always fresh vegetables that were on the table. Mm. Although there was a greengrocer that Mum would go to in Cuba Street in Palmerston. The parents of Joe Singh, who became a photographer in town. Yes. His parents were greengrocers in Cuba Street.
Yes. Yeah.
And that was Mum's preferred greengrocery at the time. Earlier than that, she used to go to a greengrocery that was in Coleman Place. Mm. alongside the small Watson Brothers shop that they had that was not their main shop. Watson Brothers' main shop used to be in the square, but Watson Brothers had a small one that was run by a chap, Mr. Kelly.
And that was selling what?
It was selling biscuits and green, all stuff you'd get from a grocery.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So
and then alongside that was a greengrocer. Yeah.
So why would you, if you were growing your own, is it because of storing
out of season, out of season, stuff like that?
Okay. Yeah.
I would think. I mean, I didn't ask those sorts of questions in those days.
No, yeah, you just.
I can remember.
Well, did you have many sort of imported things like bananas? And I suppose you grow oranges here.
Bananas, yeah, yeah. We used to get. Yes, we got bananas, oranges. Probably a lot were locally grown, but out of season we also got what were called outspan oranges. Outspan were oranges that were imported from South Africa.
Okay, yeah.
And then I can remember there was a time when Mum suddenly said, I'm not going to buy any more of those. We never knew the reason why she didn't buy them until much later, and it was just her small protest about what she felt was happening in South Africa.
Yeah.
But that was, I mean, and that was in the middle 50s when she was talking like that.
Yeah.
So she was a fairly socially conscious person.
So she was aware of those sorts of things.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz. If you're a fan of NPR, listening to our podcasts and live stream has never been easier. Just search for accessmedia.nz on the App Store or Google Play and download the app with the kiwifruit logo. Once you've got it, pick Manawatu People's Radio from the list of stations and go find your new favourite show.